All right, we got up to slide 8, which I haven't mentioned anything about yet. We're almost through Mendelian genetics, but what we see here is a special kind of cross. We were talking about monohybrid cross before. This is something different. This is a test cross. Actually, there are different kinds of test crosses, but this is one kind of test cross that is for the purpose of determining the genotype of a dominant phenotype individual. And so first, just make sense of why this is a problem. As we've talked about, when we have complete dominance of one allele over the other, one, and therefore one trait over the other, the only way for an individual to have the recessive trait is to be homozygous recessive, right? Like the white-flowered individuals. So in that case, just observing the individual with an individual with a recessive trait, of course, tells you the phenotype just by observing it, because that's what you're observing is the phenotype. But it also tells you the genotype, since there's only one possible genotype for that phenotype. But when you look at a purple-flowered individual, which is, of course, not recessive, it's dominant, has the dominant trait, then you know by observing it only the phenotype. You know it's purple-flowered, you know it's the dominant phenotype, but you don't know what the genotype is, because there's two ways for an individual to have the dominant phenotype. It can be homozygous dominant, or it can be heterozygous. So this test cross is designed to determine which of those is true. It has to be one of the two possibilities. And in this case, what you do is take that dominant individual that you don't know the genotype of and cross it with a recessive individual. But before you actually cross it, you can make two separate Punnett squares, one for each of the two possibilities. Because you know this purple-flowered individual is either upper P or upper lower P, homozygous or heterozygous. And therefore, each of those possibilities corresponds to a different Punnett square. Right? If this purple-flowered individual is actually homozygous, then you would get this left Punnett square. And notice that a Punnett square, by the way, is a prediction. It tells you the predicted ratio of offspring. And this Punnett square predicts 100% purple-flowered offspring. It's not possible for a homozygous dominant individual to have recessive offspring, because the way dominance works is that it only requires one dominant allele to make that offspring fully dominant, and that's the only kind of allele that a truly homozygous dominant parent can pass on to the offspring. On the other hand, if the purple-flowered one is heterozygous, then you would have this right Punnett square, which predicts that half of the offspring should be purple and half should be white-flowered. Well, once you have those predictions in hand, then you actually go through with the cross and look at the offspring. And if you did this particular cross and you got any white individuals, that would eliminate this possibility of the purple-flowered unknown one being homozygous, right? Because white is impossible. So it doesn't matter how many whites you get. If it's one or more, you know that then the purple-flowered one you're trying to figure out the genotype of is definitely heterozygous. On the other hand, if you get nothing but purples, it kind of depends on how many there are, right? You could just get lucky and get three purple individuals out of three. If, on the other hand, you have a lot of offspring and they're all purple, then it's more and more likely that this left one is the correct one. That's one use of a test cross, though. Now we go to 9, look at a different kind of cross. This is a dihybrid cross. So compare that word to monohybrid that we talked about before. A hybrid cross is one in which the parents differ in their traits, right, for a given characteristic. A monohybrid cross pays attention to just one characteristic. Well, a dihybrid cross is just like it, except that simultaneously you're paying attention to two different characteristics. And those characteristics don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. You're just choosing to pay attention to both of them. All right? Otherwise, it's the same. So in this case, what are the two characteristics?
The color and shape of the bean.
Right. Seed color and seed shape. And each of those, just like for the monohybrid cross we've done, each of those characteristics has two possible traits. So there are two colors possible, green and yellow, and there are two textures or shapes possible, round and wrinkled. Well, as we see here, because of the genotypes, since we're using Y and R, yellow is dominant over green, that's why we're using Y's, and round is dominant over wrinkled, which is why we're using R's. By the way, notice the genotypes for the two parents here. They are four characters long. There's two Y's and two R's. What does that tell you? Well, the cross is dihybrid, but what does upper Y, upper R tell you? Yes, but why are there two Y's and two R's?
There's two alleles that traits that they're looking at?
No, that's why there's a Y and an R. Why are there two of each? Because it's diploid, exactly. So there's four overall characters, but it's a diploid genotype because there's two of each of two different genes, right? Two alleles for each of two different genes. And so, yes, you're right that this parent is a doubly homozygous dominant individual, this yellow round one. So it's homozygous dominant for color, upper Y, and independently, but simultaneously, it is homozygous dominant for shape, round. It's upper R. The other one, on the other hand, the other parent, is doubly homozygous recessive. Homozygous recessive for color, which is why it's green, and homozygous recessive for shape, which is why it's wrinkled. Well, once again, in order for these two parents to have offspring, they have to first make gametes. And gametes are produced in diploids by meiosis, as we've talked about, which randomly chooses one allele or the other for whichever characteristic you're talking about. Here we're just talking about two characteristics. But if you randomly choose one of the Y's and randomly choose one of the R's, since they're true breeders, there's still only one possible gamete that each of these parents can make, right? That's why all of the gametes are going to be upper Y, upper R from this parent, and lower Y, lower R from this parent. Notice that these are, as gametes should be, these genotypes are haploid. That's why there's only one of each kind of symbol, only one Y and only one R. Well, since these are the only two possible gametes for these parents, when they get together, there's only one possible offspring genotype, right? Upper Y, upper lower Y, upper R, lower R. In other words, every one of the offspring is going to be doubly heterozygous. And because of dominance of color and dominance of texture, every one of the F1s is going to be yellow and round. So this is just like the monohybrid cross, except we're simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics. Okay, then we get to this fork in the road. And there's two Punnett squares here, similar to the situation in the previous slide, because there are two possibilities being tested here. One is the possibility of dependent assortment. The other is the hypothesis or possibility of independent assortment. Well, it's already been spoiled for you, right? You already know, because I've lectured to you about this, that assortment, real assortment, is independent, not dependent. But what does assortment refer to? Well, maybe I spoke too soon when I said you already know. You were already taught, I can say that.
the way that the gametes are produced, like the way that it lines up the traits?
Well, eventually you'll get the gametes, but it's a little early in the process to talk about gametes. The way in which what line up?
The chromosomes?
More specifically, tetrads. Because remember, there's two lining up events in meiosis, one in meiosis 1 and one in meiosis 2. We're talking about meiosis 1. That's when assortment matters. And assortment refers to how a tetrad lines up. Okay? Well, dependent assortment would mean that in using the red and blue scheme that we were using in those previous slides when we talked about independent assortment, that would mean all the reds go to one cell, all the blues go to the other cell. They all line up with red at one pole and blue at the other pole. That would be dependent assortment. Okay? And I've already told you that's not what happens. I mean, it's possible for that to happen just randomly, but it doesn't have to happen. Because it's really independent assortment. Each tetrad flips its own coin to determine which way red goes and which way blue goes. Okay? But these two Punnett squares are correct for each of the two possibilities. It's just that only one of the possibilities is true. Okay? Well, if you had dependent assortment, then the F2 would not involve any offspring that aren't like either parent. All of the offspring would have to be like either one parent or the other for both of those characteristics. That's why the only possibilities here are yellow and round, which is like one parent, or green and wrinkled, like the other parent. On the other hand, if you have independent assortment, then there can be a mix and match, and you can have offspring that aren't like either parent. Notice in the bigger Punnett square, which is the one that's actually correct, you have yellow and round individuals like one parent, green and wrinkled like the other parent, but you also have some that are yellow and wrinkled, so they're the color of one parent and the shape of the other, and some that are green and round. All right. And the reason I say this is correct is because when you actually go through with this real cross, then you do find all four of these possibilities. So this is a bigger Punnett square simply because there are more possibilities. There's four different possibilities for each heterozygous gamete producer to produce these gametes, right? If what this cross is to make the F2, remember, is an F1 crossed with another F1. So, and we've already established that all of the F1s are doubly heterozygous. So you have upper Y, lower Y, upper R, lower R crossed with the same thing, right, to produce the F2. Well, when this parent goes through meiosis to produce gametes, it's going to randomly choose a Y and a randomly choose an R. So it can be upper Y, upper R, lower Y, upper R, upper Y, lower R, or lower Y, lower R. Those are the four possible gametes. Similarly for the other one, only it's going to be an egg instead of a sperm. And since there's four possibilities for each gamete type, there's 16 possible offspring. That's why it's a bigger Punnett square. And by the way, since it's a dihybrid cross and a bigger Punnett square, there's a different important ratio. It's a more complex ratio because we're simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics. So instead of it being a 3-to-1 ratio, it's a 9-to-3 to 3-to-1. Notice those four numbers add up to 16. So it's 9 dominant color, dominant shape, to 3 dominant color, recessive shape, to 3 recessive color, dominant shape, to 1 recessive color and recessive shape. There's only one way you can get a green wrinkled one, which is a doubly recessive individual, and that's if you get a doubly recessive gamete combined with another doubly recessive gamete. Okay? So 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 is the That's the important Mendelian phenotypic ratio for the F2 generation in a dihybrid cross. All right, now to 10. Well, this Punnett square is showing pennies being flipped, and that's just to show you that this is all probabilistic. You can think of it purely mathematically. When there's two possible gametes that can be produced because the parent is heterozygous, and therefore you can pick either the uppercase or the lowercase, it is entirely random and exactly equal in probability. So it is exactly analogous to flipping a coin. It's 50% each. And therefore you can think of it as, is this upper left zygote in the Punnett square as having a probability of happening that's equal to the probability of this gamete multiplied by the probability of this gamete. So 50% or 0.5 times 50% or 0.5 is 0.25, 25%. And they're all equally. That's why 1/4 is 25%. So it's just a different way of looking at looking at it probabilistically. All right, now in 11, we're starting the second half of the second major part of this chapter. What we just have finished is Mendelian genetics. And that's not all of genetics, because Mendelian genetics, named after Mendel in his honor, is how things work under certain preconditions. You have to have some prerequisites that are met in order for things to happen in a Mendelian fashion. So there's two major things that need to be true for things to happen in a Mendelian fashion. This applies to everything we've already talked about, but not to what we're about to talk about. But the two assumptions for Mendelian genetics is that for whatever characteristic you're looking at, there are exactly two alleles. That's what I was talking about when I said he probably got slightly lucky as well, because in all seven of his experiments, there were exactly two alleles for each of the genes he was talking about. There's two ways of saying it, since there's a correspondence. For every characteristic, there are exactly two traits, which is exactly the same thing, or corresponds to. For every gene that you're looking at, there's exactly two alleles. All right, that's one condition for Mendelian genetics. The other is that one of those two alleles completely dominates over the other, which is how things have been up to now, right? That's why a heterozygous individual that, of course, by definition has just one dominant allele is phenotypically identical to a homozygous dominant individual, because it takes only one. Having that second one doesn't make you any more of the dominant phenotype. Okay? All right, so that's what's been true up to now. But, of course, one or both of those assumptions can be violated. It doesn't have to be true for both of those. And therefore, there's a whole set of genetics called non-Mendelian genetics, which are different ways that they are exceptions to Mendelian genetics. And the first of those is in slide 11, using a different plant. The category that we're looking at here, the reason that this is non-Mendelian genetics, the category of exception, is called incomplete dominance. And the name just by itself should tell you that it's an exception to Mendelian genetics, because I just told you that one of the assumptions is complete dominance, right? This is incomplete dominance. There is still a dominance relationship. There are still exactly two alleles. What is the characteristic we're looking at here?
Color.
Flower color, yes. And so we're dealing with one gene corresponding to one characteristic. There are two alleles, and that's one of the Mendelian assumptions, but you have to fulfill both of them. So there's two possible alleles, red and white. But in what qualifies this as incomplete dominance is that although red does dominate over white, it doesn't do so completely, meaning that in incomplete dominance, a heterozygous individual is only partially expressing the dominant phenotype. The dominant phenotype is redness, right? So a heterozygous individual, which would be upper R, lower R, well, here they're using C for the color gene and then a superscript with either R or W. So the heterozygous individual would be C, uppercase R, C, uppercase W. That individual is expressing redness because of that red allele that it has, but not as much redness as an individual that has two red alleles, a homozygous dominant individual, in other words. Now, if you think about what we've learned as far as how genes work, this should make sense to you. Because, as I've told you, it's proteins that actually give you your traits, right? But genes determine what kind of proteins you're able to make through transcription and then translation. If you're a heterozygous individual, or if this plant is, that means it has only one dominant allele means the DNA, right? It has just one in its library. So if you're going to transcribe the gene, that individual is going to, in a given amount of time, only going to produce half as much mRNA as an individual that has two red alleles. You see what I'm saying there? And if you make only half as much mRNA, then you're going to end up making only half as much of the protein in translation when the mRNA gets translated. And for certain characteristics, half as much of the protein makes the difference. For others, half as much is enough. But in this case, it's not. And that's why the flower is partially red or pink. All right, that is incomplete dominance. Notice that, by the way, when looking at the Punnett square, you have two alleles, but that ends up allowing for three different traits. Three different phenotypes. Okay, now to 12. And this human example, using the ABO blood group, it's actually an example of two different exceptions to Mendelian genetics. Either one by itself would be an exception. They're not really related to each other, but it represents two different ones. The first one I'll talk about is that it's an exception because it is an example of what's called multiple alleles. Now, multiple doesn't mean two or more, like it does in everyday language. Multiple here means more than two. Because remember, the Mendelian requirement is that you have exactly two. Well, anything more than two alleles in the population possible, then you don't have Mendelian genetics anymore. So this is not like any of Mendel's seven experiments, because in each of those there was only two possible alleles for the gene that he was interested in. Here you have three different alleles. And the gene here is for the ABO blood group in humans. Now, there are dozens of different blood groups in humans, and we don't care about most of them. Most people haven't heard of most of them. But there are two that are really important clinically, which is the ABO blood group, and the reason they're so important clinically is that you can die if you get a wrong transfusion. One of them is the ABO blood group that we're looking at. The other is the RH group, and they have nothing to do with each other, which is why when you have an overall blood type, something like B negative, that's really just shorthand saying that in the ABO blood group, I'm type B, and in the RH group, which is unrelated, I'm type negative. It's just they're combining the results into one type. We're not concerning ourselves with the RH group here at all, just ABO. And I just need to quickly explain the difference between an antibody and an antigen. Antibodies are proteins that are part of the blood plasma, the liquid component that's outside of the cells of the blood, but still part of the blood. And those antibody proteins are able to recognize specific shapes because of their own specific shape. And specifically, they are able to recognize shapes of things that aren't supposed to be in your body and therefore could potentially harm you. Antibodies recognize invaders, basically. This is how viral vaccines work. Well, there's this. That's an antibody in general. An antigen is something that is able to be recognized by an antibody, like the COVID vaccine antibodies that get produced in your body when you get vaccinated, recognize COVID vaccine antigens. COVID virus antigens, I mean. Anyway, the antigens, in this case, are particles on the surface of red blood cells, or erythrocytes. And they're represented in cartoon form by these triangle and round shapes. All right? Those are the antigens. The antibodies are in the plasma, the liquid component of the blood. And what you need to understand here is that a human doesn't want to have antibodies that recognize its own blood antigens, right? Otherwise, a person's own antibodies will attack his own blood cells. So, we have three alleles here. That's why it's one. That's one reason why it's an exception. Multiple alleles. And the possibility, the I here stands for immunoglobulin. That's just another name for an antibody. But it's I uppercase A, I uppercase B, or just I by itself. Well, a type A person has red blood cells with A type antigens on the surface. And therefore, that type A person is not going to have any type it's not going to have any type anti-A antibodies in its plasma, but it will have anti-B to recognize blood that's not supposed to be there, type B blood. Okay? And just conversely, a type B is going to have B antigens and only anti-A antibodies to surveil the body for type A blood. A type AB person makes both antigens, and therefore the plasma doesn't have either kind of antibody. And a type O person doesn't make any of those two antigens, and therefore has both kinds of antibodies in the plasma. Okay, well, multiple alleles means all of those Mendelian ratios I was talking about do not apply. And this is why I said when I was talking about Mendel that if he had chosen a characteristic that with multiple alleles, then it would have been very much more confusing mathematically. It's not that really anything different is happening, it's just that the math changes when you have three possible alleles. It's still true that any given individual has two alleles because it's diploid, but there's three possible alleles in the population. All right, so that's one reason it's non-Mendelian. The other independent reason is that it is a category of exception called codominance. And I need you to not confuse incomplete dominance that we just covered with codominance. Codominance, and co means share, is the situation in which two different alleles are more or less equal in their dominance relationship, and therefore an individual having one of each of those codominant alleles will express both of the corresponding phenotypes simultaneously. So think about this in terms of ABO blood grouping. This occurs for a type AB person because A and B alleles are co-dominant to each other. Each of them is dominant over the O type, which is I by itself. But A is not dominant over B. B is not dominant over A. They are co-dominant. And what I mean by both phenotypes simultaneously being expressed is that a type AB person is just as much a type B person as a fully type B person. And at the same time, he or she is just as much a type A person as a fully type A person. The two phenotypes, A-ness and B-ness, are being expressed simultaneously in the individual. Okay? That's co-dominance. So two different exceptions. Next up is 13, using rat fur color as an example here for the characteristic. This is a category of exception called epistasis. A lot of people mispronounce it as epistasis, but it's epistasis. And epistasis is a kind of gene interaction. So first of all, the word epistasis doesn't make sense unless you're talking about two different genes. Okay? Notice here that we have two different genes that you can tell without even looking at the Punnett square. How do we know we're dealing with two different genes here? Just from the top.
The four letters, so there's two different alleles, or two different sets of alleles.
Right, there's two different kinds of symbols. B and C, right? Each one corresponds to its own gene. Okay, so there's fur color. We're talking about one characteristic here, but it involves two different genes. And specifically, what's happening here in epistasis is that the product of one gene, which, since we're talking about protein-coding genes, the product after translation is a protein of some sort. The product of one gene affects whether or not the second gene gets expressed. Okay? So we have here the B gene, which is the pigmentation gene. And what I mean by that is that depending on the alleles you have, the B gene determines what color of pigment your cells are able to make. The C gene, on the other hand, the coloration gene, is a gene that codes for a protein that is able to turn on the B gene. Okay? And it will do so only if you have at least one uppercase C. Which means if you are homozygous recessive for the C gene, lower C, then it doesn't matter what's happening in your B gene because it's not going to get turned on. C won't let it. And notice that it doesn't matter what the B's are. Anything with a double lowercase C is going to be white because the pigment isn't actually produced. C gene won't let the pigment gene work. You see that? But if you have at least one uppercase C, then it will allow the P gene to get turned on. And then it matters which kind of P alleles you have. Well, B unfortunately stands for both black and brown, but in this case it stands for black because it's dominant over brown. So, assuming that you have one uppercase C, which will allow the B gene to get turned on, then you look at the B genotype, and if there's at least one uppercase B, then it's black pigment that's produced and deposited into the hairs. If it's double lowercase B, then it'll be brown unless it's also double lowercase C, in which case it will be colorless. That is epistasis. So it's two genes, well, one gene determining whether or not the other gene works. Okay, now before I forget, call this like slide 13 and a half, because it's not this picture I'm talking about, but there's another category I don't have a picture for. And that other category is called pleiotropy. Pleiotropy is the situation in which one gene affects more than one characteristic, which is not how we've been talking about things up to now, right? Like the flower color gene that we started with. That flower color gene determines flower color, and that's the only characteristic it rules. But in pleiotropy, the same single gene can have multiple different phenotypes that it's controlling. And one example that we've already talked about is the gene for sickle cell disease, or the gene that sickle cell disease is involved with, right? The gene for hemoglobin. And that's because that same gene not only controls what kind of hemoglobin you make, but it also controls whether or not you have sickle cell disease. Those are two different characteristics. So that's pleiotropy. Now, 14 is another exception. And this one uses human skin color as an example. This exception is called polygenic inheritance. Now, what does the word polygenic tell you? Right. Poly means many. So it doesn't actually mean a hell of a lot, necessarily. Polygenic inheritance simply means a single characteristic is being controlled by multiple different genes, which is also an exception to what we've been saying, right? Flower color as a characteristic was controlled by one gene. Well, human skin color is controlled by multiple genes, each acting independently. When you have polygenic inheritance, the phenotypes, there's a lot of different phenotypes between two extremes because there's so many possibilities. And so that continuum from one extreme to the other is what we see in human skin color. Right? We ridiculously talk about black and white in humans when there's no such thing as a black human or there's no such thing as a white human. All humans are some shade of reddish brown from very dark to very light. Redness from the blood and the brownness from how much melanin is deposited in the keratinocytes or the skin cells. But that's controlled by multiple genes, and that's what's trying to be depicted here with these six little circles in each of the squares. That represents six different genes, each of which can be dark or light. But depending on how many darks you have and how many lights overall, when you count up all the genes, that determines which end of the spectrum or in between you are at. All right, so that's polygenic inheritance. Now to 15. Here we're looking at plants that you can tell are highly related. They look like the same species, right? Identical flowers as far as morphology is concerned. Their shape's the same. But obviously the phenotype is different. One of them is drastically differently colored in the flowers than the other. These are hydrangea, right? I think. Well, anyway, I think they are. It doesn't matter what they're called. But although it would be reasonable at this point, based on everything you've learned about genetics so far, to assume that these two individuals are genetically different, which is why their phenotypes are different, it's not actually true in this case. These are genetically identical individuals, but they have drastically different phenotypes. And so this brings up an important concept. How is this possible? Right. The important concept is that phenotype is really due to two different things, not just one. There is definitely a genetic component to phenotype. That's what we've been talking about all along so far. But there's also an environmental component to phenotype. We sometimes just tersely describe this with the simple phrase nature versus nurture. Nature in that phrase refers to the specific genetic combination you get when you're created. Nurture refers to how you're brought up. In other words, your environment. So the genes dictate the proteins that you're able to make, but the stuff that you're actually made out of comes directly from the environment, right? It comes from the food you eat, the things you're exposed to throughout your lifetime. In this case, I can't remember what can actually cause such a difference. It might be, for certain species, it could be a different pH in the soil, which is why genetically identical individuals can look different. But the point is that there is an environmental component to just about any characteristic. It's not entirely genetic. And this is pretty obvious when you think about identical twins, which are genetically identical, at least at the beginning of their life, except for mutations that accumulate during their lifetime, they're identical. They're identical to start. But if they are separated at birth and spend 80 years living in entirely different places of the world doing different things, then they're not going to be identical after 80 years anymore. 16 is a simple a simple demonstration of what we call pedigree analysis. These tree-like figures are called pedigrees. They are really just family trees, but using symbols to represent predecessors and successors. We use this for humans. In fact, we don't really do this so much anymore because now it's so easy to look at an individual's DNA, right? You can, for under $100, you can get your own DNA analyzed now by several private companies. It's not a big deal. But we didn't have that ability until fairly recently. And humans, for ethical reasons, aren't used in genetic studies. You don't do a test cross with a human, you know, mating that human with a recessive individual, not only for ethical reasons, it would just be a pain in the ass, right? It takes a long time to get results if you were to do that. So instead, we try to figure out genotypes of humans before the days when we could easily do so by directly inspecting the DNA, by looking at the phenotypes of the parents. And you know, when you have a parent or an ancestor somewhere before you that is recessive, then like I've been talking about, you know the genotype. Other times you have to, there's multiple possibilities, and you have to nail down a dominant individual's genotype by looking at its parents and so on. So this, making these pedigrees, is a way of figuring out the genetics of an individual without actually looking at the DNA. 17 summarizes two different tests, one on the left, one on the right. These are prenatal tests done for genetic testing of potential offspring. There are genetic disorders, some of which have no possibility of survival, for instance. So these kinds of genetic tests can allow a prospective parent to determine whether to go to term, for instance. They do the same thing. They both sample either the embryo or the fetus for DNA. They just do it at different times. So the one that's on the left is amniocentesis, because amniotic fluid, which is the liquid that the fetus is bathing in the uterus, gets drawn. Well, that liquid is not sterile. It has fetus cells that have sloughed off of the fetus itself. So that's put through DNA testing to determine genetic makeup. That's later on, actually, compared to the one on the right. Chorionic villus sampling does the same thing, but not at the fetal stage, or not at the same fetal stage, a much earlier or even embryonic stage, when the placenta is developing and is quite big. Just sample a little bit of the placenta, which is kind of an unusual organ. It's partly the parents and partly the fetuses, but it gets you fetal DNA to do the same kind of testing. Oh, and then 18 and 19 are all one table, but this is just a summary table, so just as usual, I don't read those to you, but stuff that we've covered in this chapter. And that ends that chapter.